Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast that focuses on the questions that sometimes get left a little unexplored in the Star Wars galaxy. I'm one of your hosts, Jedi Master John Mills, and with me as always is my good friend, Jedi Master Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how are you doing today?
Doing great, John. Doing great. Why does everybody want to go back to Jakku, though? That's my question. Why does everybody want to go back to Jakku?
A very good question, because as you know, the Force Awakens got unleashed on Blu-ray and digital download and thank you and DVD and whatnot. And last week we talked about the features. We rated the features, what we thought about them, what we liked, what we didn't. This week we're going to revisit Jakku and Starkiller Base and all of those places. And we're going to talk about the movie through the lens of this home release, now that we've been given the opportunity for the first time since the theaters to actually see it in our home environment. As we all know, home environment changes things. It changes whether you can pause it, whether you can fast forward it.
Changes whether, you know, you can watch it on your phone while you go to the bathroom instead of having to, like, pause the movie. You just pause the movie there and pick it up
true.
On your phone. You know what I'm saying?
Right. You can carry it around. You can watch it in bed. So you can have some intimate time with The Force Awakens, which is, you know, hey, we're not judging. And so basically, I want to dive right into it, of course. And Matt, now that you've had a chance to watch it at home on your undoubtedly theater-sized television screen, in your perfect surround sound theater that you have in your house, your fortress, if you will.
A solitude, one might say.
Well, you let people in there from time to time, I think.
They have to be kind of special.
Did you have a different experience? Do you have a different opinion of The Force Awakens now that you've had the opportunity to watch it in the comfort of your own home?
This is a really great question. It's something that I've been wrestling with the film. I mean, I feel like, and you know this, John, the moment that we both saw it and we were texting back and forth after our first viewing. I mean, I know it was super late for you, but you were still jazzed because you're on the East Coast, I'm on the West Coast, and we were talking back and forth, and I know we were both wrestling with the film. And I feel like I have been wrestling with the film since it came out. And
sure.
I think I've been having a harder time with it still than you have, is my take, just for some of our conversations. And I think I've finally just kind of come down where I'm going to stay with The Force Awakens, which is, it is good, I like it, it's just not great. The reason I say that is because the more I watch it, unfortunately for me, the more I'm reminded that JJ is a good mimicker, but I don't think he's really good at stretching the Star Wars universe. And I think after coming off of the prequel trilogy, the Clone Wars trilogy, where George really spent a lot of time stretching what Star Wars was and giving us a lot to chew on and a lot to think out. In fact, I even think, you know, when we talked on the 602 Club through the entire saga together.
Yes.
I came away with the realization how much deeper the themes are in the prequel trilogy and how much there was to wrestle with and how relevant it still was. And what frustrates me still about The Force Awakens is that it could have been a more relevant film. And one, I think, that was more important with more to say if JJ had took the time to allow those story points that would have been resonant to come forward instead of always going for faster, more intense with just the running and the sweating and, you know, jumping from thing to thing. So it's not bad. It's just it needed it still needs time to breathe for me.
So if I'm reading you right, basically what you're saying is that this is Star Wars purely as entertainment and not as art.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Okay.
You know, and now let me say, I think, you know, the original Star Wars film is such a hallmark because it had all of that entertainment value, but it also had the thing of being able to introduce us into a world of storytelling of archetypes and the hero's journey that we just weren't getting in the 70s. Does that make sense?
Well, the thing is, Star Wars, the original Star Wars, has the advantage of occurring essentially in a vacuum. The Western had died out by and large, Westerns were gone. And so Star Wars, in a sense, even though it's, you know, a sci-fi fantasy tale, it slid into that Western category of the hero, or even the pirate story, or, you know, the old swashbucklers. And that's what Lucas was trying to go for. I will never forget the exact quote from the original making of Star Wars that aired on television back in the 70s. Where he said that he just wanted to make a good, wholesome adventure. Now, I think that the original Star Wars is just that, is in fact a supremely crafted piece of entertainment that becomes art by virtue of its execution,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
The depth that is, a lot of the depth that is read into the original Star Wars now is added on through layers of The Empire Strikes Back, then Return of the Jedi, then the prequels and the Clone Wars, and all of that stuff adds into that. And in actuality, you can tell that it's the work of a filmmaker who's going for broke.
Yeah, definitely.
Lucas didn't think he was going to get to make another one. He'd been disappointed by THX-1138, and so he was like, I'm just putting it all out there, and it's just going to get done. All that being said, Where I will agree with you is that Abrams doesn't color outside the lines. He stays in this established universe. And I think that in a lot of ways, when we've discussed this before, though I've warmed up to several of the design aspects, it still will always sort of stick in my craw that there was no, like, at the very least, the design aesthetic was stretched with each new movie. Even if they were
definitely
varying a theme, the TIE Fighters changed from Star Wars to Empire, as do the Star Destroyers, because they wanted to make them better. And the Executor, or Executor, however you want to pronounce it, the Super Star Destroyer, that becomes a statement about Star Destroyers in general. And then they don't even need to. They add TIE Interceptors and A-Wings and B-Wings and TIE Bomb. All of these things get added in, and then you have the prequels as this explosion of design, whereas there's very much a feeling of static about the design aesthetic in The Force Awakens. There's still some very successful moments. Like, I think Kylo Ren was a design that I didn't like at first, but I've really warmed to, and I've come to love the design aesthetic behind that, the lightsaber, the helmet, all of that. And I don't want to belabor the point, but like, there are still good parts of it, but I think that if you're going to knock it on anything, it's the fact that JJ's coloring within the lines. He doesn't, to borrow your term, he doesn't push. He doesn't stretch outside of a comfort zone, either for himself or the audience.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, let's just take the finalizer, the Star Destroyer. There's nothing super exciting about it. I mean, it's kind of got this weird middle cutout. Like, we didn't have the money to finish all those decks, so.
No, see, the thing is, I found that actually to be an exciting and neat little tidbit. What really, I mean, like, if I'm going to go after the military hardware, for me, it's the introduction of missiles into this era of Star Wars. Like, we got missiles in Revenge of the Sith, and in the ground combat on with Attack of the Clones on Geonosis. But the missiles in this, like, I thought were a neater, cooler execution of the missile idea, if you will. Although it took me two viewings to get visually where Poe and Finn were flying through the center of that ship. Like, the color, this is going to sound weird, but the color of it was too dark. Like, I want it, that Star Destroyer needed to be brighter.
Well, and not just that, but I would say this too, is that George was so good at establishing shots so that you saw, you knew, you understood the geography. That is something that JJ and his editor don't do. They don't really.
Well,
they just. And I think
with
that
with the finalizer, it's a little tough. I agree with you. I mean, the thing is, watching it again at home, I get the sense, in all honesty, what has made me warm to it a bit is I feel like this is the closest we are ever going to get to a Star Wars movie directed by Steven Spielberg, which is what Return of the Jedi was supposed to be. If there's any influence on J.J. Abrams that shines through in every one of his works, it's Spielberg. And I think that this is a Star Wars Spielberg movie.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and I can definitely see that. And as much as I like Spielberg, you know, I don't feel like that his movies resonate as thematically when he's not working with George, because there's a lot of interesting thematic elements that come out in Indiana Jones, but those come from the writing, not from the directing. Now, please, Spielberg did
Raiders.
Things like Schindler's List. That's what I'm saying, though, is that his more popcorn features tend to be very popcorny and very featurey. There's not tons of substance. And so, say again here in The Force Awakens, there is a place that substance could have been really added, but they shy away from adding in that substance, and they let the ancillary materials kind of give that to you, which is, it's unfortunate. It's just unfortunate.
Well, here's the question I have, okay? Because, I mean, we could quibble back and forth, and we have in the past about, you know, like, well, there's a lot of ancillary materials with the originals that informed that we didn't even realize it was doing that, and the toy, blah, 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 blah. So I want to ask you, because there's a theory that I was introduced to at a young age that I've always sort of, like, held on to. It was an uncle of mine that said this.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask me why it's hung on to me. It's a really long story. Nothing bad. It was just an artistic discussion with an uncle. But he was the first one to introduce me to the thought that even if an artist doesn't intend for a certain meaning to be there, basically an artist's subconscious, I guess he was a Freudian, an artist's subconscious comes through in his work. And I want to know if you subscribe to that theory. Is it possible for you that there is a meaning even unintentionally infused within this work that could give it a richer depth?
I definitely suppose that there could be. And I guess that leads me to a question that I had for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any deeper meanings in The Force Awakens, you know, beyond just, I guess, the very... I don't know. Do you find something of real depth and value in this, or is it more popcorn wars?
You know what? I will say that it was the home viewing that solidified, because I really chewed on it for a long time. And viewing it at home helped solidify a read that I have of it that I think is unintentionally there. I think it's actually unintentionally there. I think if you went to Abrams or even Kasdan and said, and gave them this read, they'd be like, what? I don't know. But if you take the storyline of Han Solo through this film, you're seeing in a subconscious way, Abrams exploring the idea of Lucas himself as it relates to his own big creation. And you see, you know, a lack of respect shown to him by the people who say, you've let us down before. And here's this old man who's legendary, who's saying, wait, no, I've still got something in me. And there he's surrounded by, if you want, you know, the Guavian Death Gang and the Conja Club are fans that are like, no, we're through with you. But then you have Rey and Finn as sort of the believers in Lucas, carrying him through. But eventually, Lucas cannot escape the fact that the fans have rejected him by and large, over time. You still have, again, and so you have that moment where the father goes to confront, you know, I mean, the son, who is essentially all of these people, the embodiment of all of these people that he has inspired and, you know, shown a way to, and they have turned their backs on him and they're done with him. And he can't escape it. And his time in this world is over.
So you're saying that J.J. Abrams is Kylo Ren?
No, I actually think that Kylo Ren is more in a, you know, more indicative of just the fans in general, Kevin Smiths of the world, if you will. Whereas if you look at Rey and Finn, you can kind of see some Abrams in them, right? Either one of them, where they still recognize their own, that they're neophytes. I mean, if anything, you want to put Abrams into Rey, because Rey is the one that figures out, no, I'm the one that can save this. Now, again, I know that this could be a stretch, but for me, it's a meta read that actually works with the movie overall.
I mean, I like that. I think it's definitely valid. If you see it in the movie, nobody can take that away from you. I think it, and it's great that you do. I think maybe part of it, and I'll just be honest, I think I was spoiled by the prequels and the depth that we could mine and talk about for hours on end, the discussions that you got about the mythology and everything else that came out of those. And then, you know, what they added with the Clone Wars and all. And let
me propose this idea to you, that I think that possibly another jarring thing, and this is another read that I've taken from it, is because of the way the prequels worked and were constructed, is, yeah, it all ties together, all six tie together, but they're really sort of like their own stories. They repeat in that tone poem sense, but they're not, like, you can watch just the prequels and you can watch just the originals and they still work as their own stories. Whereas Force Awakens seems to be an effort to turn the original trilogy into a six-part story as opposed to being its own three-part story. Does that make sense?
I can see that. Because I do think unless you have seen all of the films, honestly, all six, seven just doesn't make as much sense. It's so shorthand, you know, and obviously I get all the shorthand because I'm a fan. But I mean, I think if you're going into it, it's the very first Star Wars film, you know, there's so much you won't get that you won't even know you're not getting.
So you feel that if this is somebody's very first exposure to Star Wars, because, of course, we talked about on an earlier episode, viewing order, you'd never show this number one to them. This is always going to be after the original trilogy is over and done with.
I think so. Okay. Because, and the other thing about this, too, is that, you know, if you showed this to somebody first, can you imagine showing them four now after that? And then they're going to have that weird thing in their brain of, four just kind of seems like a copy of The Force Awakens, when no, it's the other way around.
No, okay, see, I'm glad you said that, because, Abrams copped to taking story beats. He did. And I will go down fighting. I will hold the flag as I charge the hill and the cannon goes off in my face, but I will completely go down swinging, saying this is not a copy of A New Hope. This is a copy of Return of the Jedi. Because if you look at the way the ending breaks down, right, the land attack plus the space attack plus the station plus all of this stuff, it's much more evocative. I feel that this is way more evocative of Return of the Jedi than it is evocative of A New Hope. And so the interesting thing about that is that Return of the Jedi itself is evocative of A New Hope. So this is an echo of an echo already.
And maybe that's why so much of it feels hollow. I think you may have just helped me figure that out. You know,
okay,
why so much of it does feel hollow. Now, this movie has some amazing things in it, and I do want to talk about those in a second, but I want to deconstruct that just a little bit more. I think that there are, as Abrams already said, there's elements already from A New Hope that we've kind of lifted and put in here. There are beats that we've literally just lifted, put here. Same thing with Return of the Jedi. And so, yes, it kind of feels like Star Wars paint by numbers. Oh, well, this works, this works, this works, this works, and this works. Put that in. You know what I'm saying? And like,
I do.
You know, and that's where I think that the difference comes from is that when you have, again, I hate to come back to this, but when you have George writing the story, the Star Wars universe is so much bigger than that in his mind. It's not just this small little thing that Star Wars is this. And this is where I think the thing becomes is like the film was made by people for whom Star Wars is only 4, 5, and 6 for the most part.
But given I agree with you about George Lucas and the man and his artistry, all of that stuff, I want to challenge you because, again, going back to the Return of the Jedi thing, Lucas himself borrowed from himself for, you know, storytelling shortcuts. They'd even, I mean, as we found out in the Making of Return of the Jedi book, they'd gone so far as to like build a mock-up of a set for the, you know, what would later be repurposed as Mustafar in episode 3, but like the big lava lair for the Emperor. They'd actually gone and built like the whole mock-up set that they could have, you know, turned into a miniature or something like that when Lucas was like, nah, I'm just going to put it on another Death Star instead of on Coruscant and sort of, you know, and pulled back. Now, again, I want to be very clear. Return of the Jedi is actually my favorite of the original 3 movies. I know that I'm a heretic for saying that, but like I'm offering that because I want people to couch that in that's coming from a place of love and not a place of, you know, the typical Return of the Jedi bashing. What is it for you that makes it not work in this case? Or are we possibly answering viewing order by saying that now authoritatively you have to have the prequels, at least one of them, as some sort of buffer between Return of the Jedi and The Force Awakens, so that you're not going Return of the Jedi straight into The Force Awakens? You're having some sort of break.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I still think because story-wise, I like the way that things progress, and that for me personally, that's just how I like to watch things. So, and that's how I would definitely show it to somebody the first time. After that, you know, do whatever you want, you know. But at least you understand the story at that point. For me, I'm with you. I think Return of the Jedi works. I like Return of the Jedi a lot. I actually like it more than Star Wars. I know I'm a heretic for saying that. The thing is that I think what makes it work is, it doesn't feel like just a carbon copy, because there is a lot of uniqueness that they added to the world, and they added a lot of things in there that, I mean, like, yes, we go back to Tatooine, but we go back to a place that we've never been before, you know, and we add a bunch of new things that really pique your imagination. You know, we go to a whole new planet with Endor, and so we're not really spending all that much time on the Death Star. You know, which is, sure. You know, we're meeting new aliens like the Ewoks and stuff. We've got,
I mean, essentially
brand new
ships. By the final cut, they've turned the Death Star into a landing bay in the Emperor's throne room.
Exactly.
Really.
Exactly. So it's not really about that. It's just about trying to put the nail in the coffin with the Empire. At least that's what we thought at that point. I think the thing about The Force Awakens is that, especially in that last act, that last third, I really do think that it becomes so much a copy. You know, you've got the lightsaber battle going on, you've got the sky battle going on, and then you have this kind of sky battle going on, you know? And
now, I'm with you. I get what you're saying, but actually viewing it at home, what's strange is I came to sort of embrace the third act this time around. And I had embraced it before, aspects of it before. But what I found this time, and I'll go ahead and say it, is maybe I don't know precisely why, but viewing it at home, the ending seemed to work better for me. And all the way up to the helicopter shot that I've spent months railing against at the very end. And that's because I think that a helicopter shot just works better on television than it does on a big screen.
Yeah, definitely.
But what I will wind up using, and I'm going to call it a cheat, although I don't think it's a cheat, although other people have said it's a cheat because they don't like it when you use it to talk about the prequels. But the whole tone poem, ring theory as it's come to be known, is something that's been... I haven't read everything about, you know, what they say in ring theory and everything, but basically, with a lot of the tone poem stuff, like, it's very evocative of Norse myth. And like, if you go to the saga of the Volsungs, it's literally people with the same names going through almost identical situations one generation after another. So that as a Western audience, we look at it and we're like, dude, like, you've even got the same name. How can you not figure out what's going on right now? Whereas for audiences back then, basically just a long way of saying, like, something that's borrowing the story beats isn't, you know, like, it's not as big a knock for me as I might have originally taken it to be. And what I found viewing it at home was I didn't even notice anything story beat evocative or repetitive or anything until after they left Jakku. Like, I was in it through that whole, that Falcon chase, honestly, is a beautifully shot sequence where, you know, where they steal the Falcon and then get away. And I originally railed against the Rathtars being like, oh, well, Han Solo doesn't need a reason to get into the ship. It felt like a forced reason to get Han Solo to get into the Millennium Falcon. But then I realized, and maybe it's because of the meta read, that the whole scene works because it actually is a really good character moment for Han Solo to lay it out there and say, he's done. Like, he's literally, he didn't do what he was supposed to do. Like, in a sense, it's a condemnation of Solo for turning his back and leaving his family. So maybe that read in and of itself sort of, triggered more acceptance on my part. I don't know.
Yeah, I like that, and I think it's really good. I think some of the things that still bother me, especially in the third act, are, and I hate to say this, but the CGI work in the sky battle is pretty awful. And there's that.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's really bad. I don't think that there's... One thing that was so great about the way that all the Star Wars films were edited beforehand is that if you were in space, you were telling a story. You were following characters. You know, Return of the Jedi is a big example of that happening when they're having their space battle. Obviously, Episode 3, the mm-hmm. beginning, is a huge example of that.
Still the best space battle
it's incredible.
Of the entire...
It's incredible. Yeah. So this one, it feels muddy and you never know what's happening. It's just stuff flying around and you're almost barely ever following a character that you even know their name. So,
oh, I see what you're saying.
Right. The actual work, the CGI work is not great. It's not at ILM's best. I don't
necessarily agree with that, the muddy and dark part, but I mean, you know, that's varying degrees of like, dislike, acceptance and stuff like that. But what I get what you're saying with the space battle is, in the space battle, let's take Return of the Jedi, for instance, because it's a sort of a one-to-one in terms of the way the battle is going. I think that this speaks to something that they didn't elaborate on enough that we dinged in our previous episode about the special features is Poe. If Lucas were telling this story, that entire flying battle would have been through Poe's point of view. There wouldn't have been been as many cuts away to pilots we've never interacted with before this moment, right? Like, there are pilots getting shot up and everything in Return of the Jedi, but they're there for a scene. Or at least with Green Leader in the Return of the Jedi battle, we're there with him the whole time. We see him at the beginning, we see him in the middle, we see him when he dies. Whereas with this, all of the pilots are given equal weight, even though Poe is the one we're supposed to care for most. And maybe that speaks to what we dinged about them not talking enough about last time, which is that must be the way they inserted Poe. That was another character, and they just said, nope, that's Poe now. You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe that's why it's muddy, is because it should have been that whole thing should have been rewritten to show Poe primarily, because he's the one we're supposed to care about.
And I also think that my ding there is about the editing of it in general. And it's all CGI work. So it's the editing of that to give you the establishing shots so you understand the geography of where you are. And again, that's something that George is really good at in the editing bay, making sure you kind of understand, okay, where is it that they're trying to get to? All of those storytelling elements that need to be there, it's just not there. And yeah, it's just another Death Star trench run that George was always telling people, don't do another trench run. Just don't do it. And you know, at least in what made it work in Return of the Jedi is that it was completely different and super exciting because it was inside the death. I mean, you know, like...
Well, I mean, the thing is that quote-unquote trench run is just a final run. Like, all of the fighting didn't occur in the...
Right.
It's different enough.
Right. Well, now, no, it's almost like a video... I mean, at that point, it was almost like a video game where you're trying to maneuver your vehicle through, you know, the deadly traps so that you can, you know, shoot the thing. And it was an incredible feat in you know, 83.
Now, the thing is, speaking of the story beats, we've hit on a couple of story beats that are, you know, that were borrowed, that Abrams himself has said were borrowed. Obviously, they don't, I don't think they get as much under my skin as they do yours. Not a knock, just an observation. And what I want to ask, because I've maintained this for a long time too, is if you take the Starkiller base, and the thing is, I've been saying, if you take Starkiller base and you don't make it a giant Death Star, if it's just a base somewhere and they throw the Resistance declares war, does the movie work better for you if you don't have this hyper light speed Death Star weapon firing on and destroying the Republican world? And then I have a follow up question. That's a yes or no. Does it work better if you subtract the long distance Death Star?
Yes.
Okay. Second follow up question. If you keep the long distance Death Star, but you open the movie, Not the right opening, not right away on Jakku or anything like that, but you have them destroy the Republic homeworld, not in the second act, but in the first, destroy the Republic early on, have it be some sort of retaliation for something, for failing to get the Skywalker location or whatever you want to make it. Does it work better then if the Republic homeworld is destroyed way earlier to make it more of the whole movie a coming out party for the First Order?
No, because I still think that what needs to happen is we need to understand the New Republic. We need to have some sort of feeling towards the New Republic, because the only thing you feel when you see that world destroyed is, what's that? Oh, it's the Republic. Okay, thanks for telling me that, Finn, but I don't care. I don't care because they've given me no reason. They haven't earned that moment.
People have countered that. I'm not saying I'm one of them, but people have countered that as saying you don't know anybody on Alderaan, and Alderaan gets destroyed.
No, but you know Leia, and you know that's her home planet, and you know her family is there.
Right.
And so that's what makes it mean something. But I'm not taking
up that. But the thing is, I would say if you move it to the first act, and you have Leia escape. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, you could do...
Have Leia escape.
What you could have done, and this would have been brilliant, open the film with Leia in front of the Senate.
Right.
Asking for more help for the Resistance. And as she leaves, she's warning them, saying, the First Order is stronger than you know. Have her be able to you know, get off the planet, and the next thing you know, the planet's being blown up. You have set up an amazing...
Right, and the Resistance is something that she set up under shell corporations.
Right, yeah.
That, right. Okay, now we're essentially rewriting the movie at that point.
And we're doing a good job of it.
Well, but given that, I agree with you. You and me, seeing her in the Senate pleading her case, we're like, yeah, that's it. But people very specifically, I mean, is it possible that we just need to accept the idea that, I mean, people rejected the prequels. They didn't. Not everybody. Obviously, not everybody. The prequels are actually better reviewed than people give them credit for. But at least popular perception-wise, they wanted to stay away from anything having to do with a plea to the Senate. They didn't want to have a Senate hall or Senate chamber.
No, because, and I reject that, and I throw a challenge flag on it, because I think the way that you make it work is, one, it's Leia. And we already have a connection with Leia. All the fans already have a connection with Leia. And put it this way, too. Fans already have in their mind this idea that Leia is involved in politics after Episode 6. Because so many of us have read the books and everything. So I think it works. And again, it doesn't have to be a long scene. And the rest of the movie is not going to deal with politics. But if you open it up like that, it really sets up this amazing... What we were talking about earlier, I was saying, it gives resonance, this idea that there's an enemy out there that people don't want to take seriously. There's one person out there who's crying in the wilderness saying, yeah, listen to me, or we're gonna face something terrible. You know what I'm saying?
I hear you. I think you and I were very much in agreement on that. So all of that said, though, is it possible for you, if they come back, you know, with Episode 8, because Abrams said in that recent interview, he said, this is only supposed to be a bridge. I'm queuing it up. I'm teeing up the ball for somebody to come in behind me and just knock it out. You know, I'm soft, slow pitching it. And Rian Johnson's going to come in and he's going to knock it out of the park. Right. Does this movie, does your estimation of it improve if the next one addresses those things that you wanted to see?
I think this is my feeling of what's going to happen to Episode 7 as we move forward down the line, is it's going to continue to get weaker and weaker and not better and better. I think the problems in the film are going to get more and more apparent to people as time goes on, not less apparent. Because what's going to happen is, I think Rian Johnson's going to come in and he's just going to kick our ass with something awesome. I really think that's what's going to happen. I think he's really going to give us something that adds something to the Star Wars mythos. In the same way that, John, we've talked about in the 602 Club, the frustrations that we have with Star Wars Rebels, when it's not giving us the mythology, it's just kind of wasting time. Star Wars, this is Episode 7. I don't want to be reintroduced to Star... I don't need to be reintroduced to Star Wars. You're making an assumption that is wrong. Now, apparently people loved it, which is great, and I like it. But I also felt like I'm taking baby steps, and I don't want to take baby steps.
Where I'm coming from now, the different angle I'm coming from, and I hear you. I think I was at your point, and I've sort of like switched around. And I think the reason I switched around is because I view this is the Star Wars movie that isn't about now, and this will sound terrible, but I think this speaks to what Abrams said. This is the one that's not about story. It's about character. And I think that that makes it unique and different in terms of being a Star Wars movie. Because with a Star Wars movie, the whole joke was always faster, more intense, faster, more intense. And you even see in some of the behind-the-scenes stuff with Episode 3, like Hayden Christensen delivers a line and Lucas is like, cut, okay, next setup. And you actually see Christensen go up to him and say, I didn't like the way I did that. Can I do it just one more time, please? And Lucas is like, no, it's fine, it's fine. And Christensen is like, no, please, just one more time, please. And I think that we're very used to Star Wars being about story, because that was Lucas's whole thing. He even copped to it. Story, story, story. And I think that this is a Star Wars movie as a character piece.
No, because, I agree.
And as a character piece, I think it's a tremendous success. I love what they do with Han. Right. I love what they do with Rey. I love what they do with Finn. I even love what they do with Poe. And BB-8, who's a great character. And if this is, in fact, a handoff character piece, a way to get us to a place where we accept these characters as our main ones, then I think my estimation of it, I think that you and I were economists and we're looking at it, and I think we both predict accurately that it's going to come to some people's opinion of it is going to fall over time. Some people's opinion of it is going to raise. But I think that if there's a median line, like I'm on the north side of the median line and you're on the south side of the median line. So you view it as falling to a certain point. I view it as sort of stabilizing to a certain point.
And I think the reason that I get everything you're saying, but the problem is that I have with it is that it could have been story and character. JJ had all the pieces there, and I feel like he just didn't do it. Like, he made the decision, the legitimate decision for himself. No, we're going to take some of these story elements out that we have in the script. We're not going to use them. And it was a mistake. I think it's a huge mistake, because I think you could have had story, resonance, and character. And this movie could have been, I could have maybe called it one, the best Star Wars movie. That's my frustration and my anger with JJ. I feel like he just threw away the opportunity to make the best Star Wars movie ever and instead made the most okay Star Wars movie ever. And because the plot points, I think, as we've talked about before, especially in the 602 Club, were there for them to make this film big and have something important to say. I don't feel like this film has much important to say because they cut out the important parts.
Okay. Now, as a final question, in terms of, and this is what I want to highlight very much, is rankings for movies are fluid, so far as I'm concerned. They can change.
Yes.
There could conceivably be a time in my life where Episode 3 is not the best Star Wars movie ever made. I don't foresee it happening, but it could. Where do you have it ranked right now in terms of Star Wars movies? Not including the holiday special.
No, I don't. I'm not that kind of person, John. You know that. I don't play that game, you rogue. For me, this is the sixth.
So this is number six. So which one of the originals did it beat for you?
Oh, it didn't beat any originals.
It didn't beat any of the prequels?
You said originals.
Well, I consider the prequels originals because I'm not a jerk.
I see. Gotcha. the only prequel that this beats is Episode 2 and the Clone Wars movie. So,
interesting. You will consider me a heretic then.
That's fine.
Because for me, I actually have this presently because I'm looking at my Letterboxd list.
Yep, me too.
Because Letterboxd is beautiful for lists.
It's beautiful.
And keep in mind, and I actually have this on the front of my Star Wars films ranked list on Letterboxd, subject to update depending on mood. Okay, so it could update. Right now, it's number five on the list.
I do want, I feel like I've come off really hard on the movie, and maybe partly is that, I don't know, I guess I listen to enough podcasts and I don't feel like people are really hard enough on the film as they should be. So I feel like it's maybe my job to be that lone voice in the wilderness. And I'm okay with being John the Baptist eating locusts and wearing, camel hair.
Oh, no. You don't get to claim the John the Baptist throne. If anybody's going to get his head cut off for not being able to keep his mouth shut, Matthew, it's me.
This is probably true. But I want to say, for me, what really works in the film is the characters of Rey, Poe, and Finn. I really like those characters. And it, when you were talking about character, it's those moments, you know, what works for me in the end of the film is Rey and her awakening. You know, all of that I just think is so good. I love Maz Kanata. I love that character. I think she's phenomenal. Yeah. I can't wait to see more of her. I love some of the background characters, like the Crimson Corsair in Maz's cantina.
Crimson Corsair. Yeah. Black Series figure. We were talking about
this
today.
We need it. That figure. You know.
Need it. And General Hux.
Yeah, General. I like General Hux. I think he's really interesting. So there's a lot of great work that they did here. My frustration came from my love of Star Wars and the knowledge that I felt like this had all the pieces to be even better, and it just, they missed the mark. And so, and I, you know, for me, I might be weird. I have one last question for you, John.
Yeah.
Because for me, Han's death means nothing. Like, I still feel nothing when I watch that scene.
Means everything to me. And it was, for me, I won't lie, that for me to finally really plug into it. Okay. Because, and I've said this elsewhere, and I think you've said this elsewhere as well. As soon as I heard the announcement, Harrison Ford coming back for episode 7, I looked at the person next to me and I said, he's going to die.
Yep.
And they're like, what are you talking about? I was like, there's no way Ford's coming back unless they ice him. There's just zero. I'm like, he's been trying to kill him since 1982. Okay. Give me a break. And yes, I know Return of the Jedi was released in 1983, but I'm talking about 1980. Never mind. So, okay. The reason it means something for me is, number one, I think it's played beautifully. Number two, and this is a cheat card. This is such a huge cheat card. But the way you react to any scene in a movie has to do with who you are, your surroundings, all of that stuff.
Definitely.
Who does it speak to? For me, what made it finally resonate was seeing it with my kids, because I finally plugged into it as a dad. And I can, there is a moment in that that I find so, like, I actually get a little emotional even just thinking about it. But the fact, and it's such a brilliant choice. I don't know whether this was something that Ford came up with on his own, whether they workshopped it, what they did. But the simple fact that as he's stabbed and he knows it's over, he looks at his son and he gently touches his face, as if to say, I still love you. Even now, I'm never going to stop. And not even just as a dad, but like as a parent. No matter what, your job as a parent is to go, and if your kid is making bad decisions, to go and say, stop it. You can change. You can make your life better. And then even if you're faced with the ultimate betrayal, your job as a parent is to say, you know, I still love you. Like, even though I want you to be different, even though I want you to change, even though I want you to make smarter decisions, I will never, ever give up, no matter what. And I think that scene is just beautiful as a result of that. I really do. I think that it's a scene that is, I just, for me, that's what makes it resonate.
And I mean, I feel like that is probably the reason it hits a lot of people. Is something similar. I don't know what it is. I wanted it to mean something to me, and my wife and I were watching the film, you know, just a couple weeks ago, and it still just doesn't hit me. And I know you'll call me a heretic, but the scene in Batman v Superman, the whole Martha scene, that makes me tear up. This scene doesn't. And I don't know why. I want to get there, and maybe one day I'll get there. I just want it more earned, and it wasn't earned for me with Han. And maybe it's because of just, it's so meta for me that I know he's gonna die, and so it's
right.
Like,
oh, and that, yeah. I think that is the fairest point. I think that is, anybody that came into this and not saying Han's going to die. I mean, seriously, we talked about this the first time I watched it. Yep. It's like the minute he stepped on screen, I was like, stopwatch, go. And I was just waiting for it. I was like, is he going to die? No, too early, too early, too early. Is he going to die? No, too early. Oh, this is the scene he's going to die. You know, So I do agree with you. I think that that meta knowledge thing, and maybe that's why as like an escape valve in my brain, I've sort of come up with this meta read of Han representing Lucas, is maybe there's a part of my brain that's like, okay, there needs to be another read of this so that it's not just something, because the last thing I wanted to do, because it's not a successful scene if you just boil it down to like, well, if you're not a parent, you just don't understand. You know, like that's not,
right.
That doesn't
right.
work, guys.
Well, and I mean, you know, part of it too is like, you know, Han is feeling the archetypal role of the old wizard, almost, you know, that the old man.
He's the knowledge bringer, and it's a beautiful thing that the old cynic is now the one to impart the knowledge of the Force.
Yeah, exactly. And that part I really like, you know, because they gave a new piece to his character. I think part of it for me too, and I know we're going long, but who cares? It's The Force Awakens, so we're supposed to. The thing that I wish that there had been is there been some way for us to have, and Star Wars doesn't do flashbacks, but it's like I would have loved to have had some connection to Ben and Han and Leia when things weren't crap, you know, like when their son isn't evil, so that there's that, the way that the Clone Wars gave you that thing about Anakin, so that when he fell, it's like, but he was a hero. You know, I saw him be a hero.
You know what I'm going to say is I think that this gives us an end to another look. I want at this point to do character, like one-to-one character analysis. I think we've got a series on our hands here to take character analyses and look at characters in The Force Awakens versus characters in prequels and original trilogy and that sort of thing. Because for me, Kylo Ren works as a musing on Vader. We've never seen on screen what Vader was like when he first got in his mm-hmm. armor. Like, for us, mentally, it's always been Vader gets in his armor and then all of a sudden he's walking around giving speeches telling people to knock it off. Whereas I think that this Kylo Ren is actually much more probably what Anakin was like when he first got in that armor. Right? Like, he hasn't, yeah.
Throwing temper tantrums, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, he wasn't at killing people yet.
Well, yeah.
He was just
like,
throwing temper tantrums.
Like, it wasn't, yeah. I mean, that, and that's just how I read Kylo Ren. That's why Kylo Ren works for me now as a character, because initially I was like, I'm looking for the in here. But the thing is, I see him now as somebody who truly is like his grandfather, if you will, where, to speak to Han's point, there is good in him, but like he's out of control.
Yeah, no, I think that's and that's one of the reasons I kind of came to accept him is actually he's just so much like Anakin, and I appreciated that actual connection to the prequels, that really the grandson is more like the grandfather than the parents wanted to admit. They were trying to push that away, you know, like push him into other things. And
that, well, and that's actually something that I can say, you opened up and shared a little about, you know, why Han doesn't resonate with you. And so I guess I'll close out with saying that my own anger, and this is why Anakin is a character that resonated with me from the prequels so much, when he didn't resonate for some others, I guess, is I feel like I understand him, and I feel like I understand Kylo in the sense that when I was a young man, I had real anger problems. And so I think that's sort of an in for Kylo too, is be like, like I want to go give the kid a hug, not to like demean. And it actually infuriates me when people refer to him as emo. Like that actually drives me up a wall, because like, that's the problem, is people are just like, oh geez, he's just emotional. It's like, no. Han touching him on, you know, on the face and that tender moment should have happened 10 years previous, but it didn't. And that's, you know, maybe that's another layer to Han's death scene, is Han's realizing this really is what I should have done before instead of running away.
Apparently parents in Star Wars are really crappy, except for Poe's parents. They were great. But otherwise,
You know what? I'm actually, I, I'm sick of people beating up on Owen and Beru.
No, they were great. We talked about them in our 602 Club episode, how they changed the course of Luke's life because of the love and support they gave to him for the most part.
Right. I know that it was a tough life for Luke, and he dreamed of bigger and better things. But yeah, I'd run a pretty strict household if I knew that I had adopted the child of the greatest monster in galactic history.
Oh,
I cut off the internet. It's like, no, you're not doing anything. You're going to bed at dark.
It's like trying to raise, like, you know, Superman. How do you teach a kid who has all this power and can really do whatever he wanted, you know? So
it's
the same thing.
Yeah, like every time Luke has like a temper tantrum as a kid, like Owen's hand just like sort of like gravitates over toward his rifle. Bruce's like, Owen, knock it off. It's like, no, I'm just saying.
Exactly. Oh, John, well, I think that we should probably end it there. Obviously, you know, The Force Awakens and everything in Star Wars is something that we can just be loquacious about for hours. But before we go, did want to kind of mention a couple of places that people can find us online. You can find us at thenerdparty.com. You can also find us on iTunes. You can find us, of course, on Facebook at facebook.com/thenerdparty. We're on Twitter under The Jedi Masters. And if you're wanting to know more about the Nerd Party Network that we're on, you can also follow them on Twitter now at Join Nerd Party. And John, we love to have emails from people. So if they would like to send us their thoughts and their comics, we love to hear that from you. Please send that to an@thenerdparty.com. So those are kind of all the places that you can find the show and the network. But John, there's a lot of places that you are online beyond that. So please let everybody know where they can find my gracious master friend.
Well, thank you, Matthew. You can find me trolling around on Twitter at Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE. And I mean, seriously, if you're listening to this show, you should know how to spell Kessel Junkie.
Pretty much, yeah.
Come on, guys. Yeah. You can find me actually for a little bit longer, co-hosting Commentary Trek Stars over on the Trek FM network. You can find me co-hosting another podcast called Words with Nerds that I co-host with my buddy Craig. Not affiliated with any network, but we are crazy and zany and talk about a lot of stuff. And, you know, that's where you can find me online. Matthew, where can they find you?
Well, John, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm on the Trek FM network as well on a few shows. I do one there called The Orb with Chris Jones, where we're talking about Deep Space Nine. I do Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We're interviewing the authors. I'm also on the 602 Club. We've mentioned that here before. And that's our general geek show. We cover all sorts of things on there. I mean, it's just so much fun choosing whatever's come out or something old, TV show, whatever, we're talking about it. And, of course, we have the Star Wars special feed for the 602 Club as well, which everybody should check out because, John, you're on almost every one of those shows, which is a joy. People just need to listen to that. So
It's really the godfather of this show.
That's true. It actually is. So
it gave birth to this show.
And, of course, you can find me on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. John, I think it's time to close negotiations.
Matthew, negotiations are closed.
I've got a good eye for talent. And Daisy was just doing like a little rap one day, and I just said, you know what? I can make you a big star. So we decided to collaborate on a song together. 1, 2, 3, go.
We all up in the desert and we're filming Star Wars. Because of our diet, we can't eat no Mars bars. Because of the explosion, JB crawling on our floors. Because of all the heat, we can really make some s'mores in the desert. What? In the desert. What? What? In the desert. What? In the desert. What? What?
Go to light speed.
I literally got nervous doing that.
And that's what happens when you take too long in between takes.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.